our own consciousness, and work together in a manner, say, that Stefan has remarked in part two, was done over time in American history to change from very negative attitudes, let's say, about slavery, and to be part of the initial energy behind the abolitionists working on the second original sin of America. And he also is the author daily of the Schwartz Report, which you can get at SchwartzReport.net. That's S-C-H-W-A-R-T-Z, report.net. He's got a very, very interesting personal history of civic and international engagement. We share, having been at the apex there of the Second Russian Revolution, we discovered in our last dialogue in August of 1991, I was at Woodstock for the whole time. I was at the WTO protests for a week in Seattle in 1999. I was in Standing Rock in 2016. I was at the Earth Summit in 1992, and Stefan has parallel events of where he was and what happened to him, both of us as elders here, four different occasions when Stefan has been on the spot as well at world historical changes. So, Stefan, maybe you could just, as we begin this, from racism to just a quick historical summary of where Quakerism has shown up. You yourself are not a Quaker, but you're very interested in your research and their effect on positive life-affirming policies in America, and then one or two others of your life-changing events. We've covered the fact that you were there for the Martin Luther King speech. You were there in Russia. You've got a couple others to share with us. But let's put it in the context first so we don't miss this, of how the Quakers were really at the heart of leading the abolitionist movement and the very movement that George Mason from Virginia had predicted would result in not only freeing the slaves, but in civil war, because that was not dealt with in our Constitution. And that's why he refused to sign it, as you spoke about in our last dialogue.
Well, I got interested in the Quakers because I got interested in how do individuals and small groups change the course of history? I mean, what do you do as a person? Okay, you're not very rich. You don't have any particular official position. You're just an ordinary person. You don't command troops. You know, what do you do? And in doing that research, which is what culminated in the Eight Laws of Change, after a whole series of papers, I knew about the Quakers, and I knew a number of Quakers. My wife is a Quaker. But I had never really delved deeply into their history. And what the Quakers showed me was a actual living example of how a small group of people who hold a clear intention to foster well-being can create social change. That's the important part. Because what your listeners care about is not sort of what happened 200 years ago, but, you know, what can I do today? We are in deep trouble. Everybody can recognize that, I think. Or at least most people can recognize that. So what do I do? Well, the answer is really the Quakers are a model. And here's the thing. What the Quakers figured out was that the key to doing this was not to have, you didn't have to have big, flashy things. You didn't even have to be a huge group, which is what you would think. You needed to be a small group who had a very clear, who were able to hold a clear intention. Because that's the key to the whole thing. What it gets down to is what I call the quotidian choice. And this is something all of your listeners can do, and it's something everybody can do. And the people who are listening to this program today, within the 90, whatever it is, 99 or 98 days until the election, we can change the course of the outcome of that election by doing this. Every day you are presented with hundreds of little choices. That's what quotidian means, ordinary, mundane, regular. So every day you get hundreds of little choices, where you buy your gas, where you buy your groceries, which groceries you buy, what you buy at the hardware store, all those little tiny things. Every one of those is a vote. And you're either voting for life-affirming activity or you're voting against it. So the key to this is every day you have these hundreds of these little tiny choices. First of all, be aware that you have these choices. most people, strangely enough, are not. Be aware that you're making a choice and that this choice is a vote. And of the options that are available to you as you understand it in that moment, that you consistently and universally always pick the one that is the most life-affirming, compassionate, and fostering of well-being. And that in all your interactions with people, you always choose that choice, that option, that is the most compassionate, life-affirming, and fostering of well-being. Now, that seems very simple, but it requires being present. It requires being aware. It requires understanding that you matter and that the choices you make matter. And that's what the Quakers figured out. You know, there are less than 87,000 Quakers in the United States today, out of 318 million people. In the whole course of American history, going back to the colonial era, there have been less than 500,000. This is a tiny, tiny group of people. Most people have never met a Quaker, have no idea what they believe, what their religious ceremonies are like. They don't know anything about them except that there's a picture of a Quaker on the oatmeal box. But in fact, if you look at the Quakers, you see a living example of how to do this. Because if you check every single positive, socially transformational movement that really transformed America, starting with abolition, penal reform, public education, women's suffrage, the environmental movement, the nuclear freeze, every one of those movements begins with a tiny group of Quakers. And part of what the Quakers understood was that you had to be able to do this work even though you might not get credit for it. And the key to it was that they held a common intention. We know from the sociological and neurological research that when 10% of any cohort, doesn't matter what it is, whether it's a school group or a homeowners association or a nation, when 10% of any group shift in consciousness, either good or bad, by the way, because we're now experiencing the bad part, good or bad, whenever 10% of a population of any cohort shift in consciousness, the whole cohort has to adjust to accommodate for that. And right now, what we've got is depending on who you talk to or what poll you're looking at, about 27% of the country are Christo-fascist racists.
Yeah, I've heard Noam Chomsky and also Paul Ray in his Cultural Creatives put it as high as 32-33%. It would put them close to 100 million people out of the 320 million or so Americans. Whichever one of these figures, you're getting way close to 100 million compared to 87,000 Quakers.
What the Quakers did by holding their common intention, it started with them. They're like the seed crystal.
With the clear intention that if we all take what you suggested in part two, which is if I tell 10 people about this and tell those 10 people to tell 10 people about this, we ourselves, even in this one-on-one dialogue with our deep listening audience evoking it, we actually can make a change to show that the magnitude of the possibility of even, as you say, just as Margaret Mead once said, never underestimate the power of a small group of conscious people, and you add holding a clear intention to change the world. I'm really deeply supportive of what you're saying here.
Well, thank you. And it's all science-based. I'm not...
Yes, yes.
This is not politics. We're not talking about political philosophy.
Right.
We're not talking about speculation. This is all based on research. So when the Quakers, this little group of people, held this common intention, it resonated with a larger group. And as it grew, when it got to about 10%, mm-hmm. then suddenly the country began to change. You can see this happening in Me Too. You can see this happening in gay to LGBT. You can see this happening in people not smoking.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's another great
All
one.
All of those are examples that there was no law passed. There was nobody made up a public pronouncement. These are things which changed in American culture because individuals individually made a choice to no longer hold that consciousness or participate in those activities.
let me interject the intergenerational thing, using smoking as an example, when the kids would come home from school and say, Mom, Dad, what are you doing? This is bad for your health. And let's also call attention to the role of education and how key it is, as you talk about all the time as well, for education to really be protected in our country from, for instance, the destruction that's happening right now with Betsy DeVos of the public school system and so on.
Well, actually, to mention Betsy DeVos, because she is an example of this neo-feudalism where you have a small group of people of great wealth. You have a small middle class of doctors, lawyers, people, professionals who provide services. And then you have a very large peasantry of wage earners, people who, it's not a peasantry of land as in the medieval period, it's a peasantry of employment. And what they're doing is, by trying to kill public education, is to, first of all, interject theology into it, their version of Christianity, which has nothing to do with Jesus, but anyway, their version of Christianity, and to create ignorance, because they recognize, they're explicit about it, they recognize that educated people tend to become democratic. It's not democratic so much in the Democratic Party, but they become socially progressive, let's put it that way.
Yes.
I prefer that. And When you can get enough people to hold a socially progressive perspective, then everything changes. And that's what they're afraid of, because they are terrified that a mass of ordinary Americans will shift in their consciousness in a life-affirming way, because they know that there is no force on earth as powerful as a collective, a group of people holding a common life-affirming intention.
Yes, and
so
let's...
they want to cut that off. Mm-hmm. They want to eliminate it. They want to obfuscate it. They want to create ignorant, easily pliable people.
And let's remember that I quoted there Margaret Mead, whose comment about never underestimate the power of a small group of people to change the world was based on her research all over the world as a really leading anthropologist. So it's just as you're saying, you're not making an ideological statement, or you're making a fact-based statement as she was. And this is the important inspirational aspect. This is not just somebody proclaiming this. Both she and you have done the research, her internationally in her anthropological way, and you with all of your data research that you do constantly.
Yes, I mean, here's the thing. Forget about Democrat, Republican. Just forget it. Put all that political partisanship aside. This is what you ask yourself. Is this person, of the people that I can vote for in this election, which one is going to produce compassionate, life-affirming, wellness, well-being, fostering social change? That's the question you want to ask yourself. Not, do I vote parties? Do I vote speeches?
Mm-hmm.
But which person is going to produce well-being? You know, let's take a very quick example. If you've been looking at the research recently, I've done a number of pieces in Schwartz Report about health care. We don't really have a health care system in the United States. We have an illness profit system. The function of the whole thing is not to create well people, but to make money. And it has terrible social outcomes. We have the worst maternal mortality statistics in the developed world. We have appalling child mortality, babies dying in birth. Statistics. I mean, a child born in rural southern America has less of a chance of getting to his first birthday or her first birthday than a child born in Botswana, Africa. I mean, we have terrible social outcome. Why is it that the United States, uniquely amongst the developed world, cannot seem to create a healthcare system that doesn't bankrupt people and that fosters well-being? Why is that? Are we too stupid to do it? Are we too greedy to do it? Much more important question. Everybody else can do it. We pay more for our health care by multiples, and not just a little bit more, multiples more than any other developed nation in the world. And according to the World Health Organization, we rank 37th. How is that? Why can Norway and Iceland and Finland and France and Germany and England and how can they produce universal health care which is producing well-being, and we can't do that? And that's the question that I think we need to confront. There are so many of these lies that we refuse to confront. We won't talk about racism. We won't talk about why can't we get decent health care in the United States at a reasonable price. What is it? Every other country can do it. Why can't we do it? And the reason is because in the United States we have only one social priority, and mm-hmm. that's profit.
Mm-hmm. And so that leads us directly into your July 31 issue of the Schwartz Report, which I want to just read the headlines of to people to see how informative these are, these squibs you do every day, picking out an article from your reading every single day from different topics. And they all, in a sense, provide dimensionalities to the system-wide corporatism and plutocracy that we have. We'll just head note it this way, as I did in my program on Connections on July 27 about autocracy coming to the USA. And when it comes in the form of plutocracy with a puppet autocrat like Trump, it's very much the same as the state-run plutocracy in China or Russia. There you have the state, which controls all of the billionaires and oligarchs. And here in the United States, you have the billionaires and oligarchs that control the state. The effect is the same on what's really at risk here for us, because you say that even in terms of the quotidian choice, the first thing you need to do is to be aware that you have choices. The first order of business of plutocracy, oligarchy, autocracy is to limit your choices, to put you in a state of literal economic and social and psychic serfdom. I have long talked about the new feudalism in a punning way, where I would spell it F-U-T-I-L-I-S-M. So incremental kind of change doesn't actually change the system. It is futile. So this new feudalism is an aspect of controlling people and thinking that they have choices and change when in fact they don't. And the healthcare system is a really, really good example of that. And right here on July 31, your publication of Schwartz Report, I'm going to quote the very first article, Koch-backed think tank finds that, quote, Medicare for all, quote, would cut healthcare spending and raise wages. Whoops. In other words, even the Koch brothers have stumbled onto the reality that the profit healthcare system actually doesn't work at all as well as what we see in the other industrialized nations. But then also you have an article here on what you're calling the Christo-fascists, which are another form of patriarchy. It's a religio-patriarchy that actually is limiting choices, not just for women and their bodies, but in all sorts of ways for people to actually think for themselves and discern and be able to make these quotidian choices. And another one you have just again today, as we're recording this, on July 31, is hackers break into voting machines within 2 hours at DEF CON. And your comment is the election technology of American democracy is in real trouble. This story is very alarming. And so really, our democracy is at stake. Our ability to make these choices and to get to policies that benefit people is much less than in other countries. The countries that President Trump has been reviling and mocking, the European countries. Your final article today is from Amsterdam, where they have a article in Regen Village, where they're talking about, in a half-hour commute from Amsterdam, a piece of farmland land is slated to become a new kind of neighborhood with vertical farms and traditional fields and orchards surrounding, supplying food to the people living there. Food waste will turn into fish feed for on-site aquaculture. Houses will filter rainwater but won't have driveways. A village tech platform will use AI to simultaneously manage systems for renewable energy, food production, water supply, and waste. And this is happening as we speak. This year on Earth Day, I did a dialogue here on Living Dialogues. You can get it April 22nd on that Sunday of Earth Day itself, when my old friend Mark Barish, who works around the world with agroforestry, and I were talking about moving our language, our nama rupa, our name and form, from sustainability, which has been completely co-opted by corporatism, and it's an incrementalism that doesn't change the system whatsoever. It's like a greenwashing, but regeneration. Where there are technologies out there, many of them influenced by indigenous peoples, where you combine agriculture and forestry that's being reawakened in Africa, and we've got people here in America that are drawing on these traditions now to create things like this eco-village. And so I'll give it back to you this way, Stefan. Your comment today, leading into the Regen Village article that I just quoted from, you say, while the United States under Trump and the Republicans is being taken back to the 1920s and the age of Herbert Hoover, the rest of the world is moving in a very different forward-thinking direction. And here is a wonderful example. This is not only good news from Amsterdam, it is a practical blueprint for a future that fosters well-being. So let's go right to that in our remaining minutes here. You and I have talked about what I call a reverse states' rights movement. We progressives have long thought that if we want to make social change, we have to do it through the federal government and its intervention and policies that provide appropriate social net and foster new energy. And so on. And what we're seeing is that the federal government has been completely bought and paid for, as Dick Durbin said as long ago as 2010. I'm sorry to say it, but this place, the Congress, is owned by the banks. The plutocracy right now is controlling the executive branch and also both houses of Congress. And within several weeks, if the Brett Kavanaugh nomination for the Supreme Court goes through, Trump will be looked upon in retrospect as a temporary phenomenon lasting at most 8 years. And then when he dies, there's no other kind of charismatic autocrat to take his place. But Brett Kavanaugh, together with Alito and Roberts and Gorsuch and Clarence Thomas, they're going to be around for another 30 or 40 years. Clarence Thomas, though, we have looming an even greater crisis about to happen. And what I want to throw the ball back to you, Stefan, is you and I have talked about how in where you live, especially, you know, Washington, Oregon, and California, together comprise the fifth largest economy in the world, and they can be the place in the states rather than the federal government or the federal judiciary when we can start making a new world like this example in Amsterdam. We already have California saying that any new residential housing has to have solar rooftops. So let's take it away here in our final minutes and just sketch that out about California and Oregon and Washington, and they also have movements there that you and I have talked about that I participated in last year of Native indigenous peoples showing the way with their tribal canoe trips that have been going on since 1987, where they visit each other's tribes over a three-week period and respectfully ask for permission to land, and they honor each other's cultures, they share their dances, and so on.
Well, what we're seeing, I think, in response to this rise in neo-feudalism, is a growing sense amongst the blue value states that, A, they're tired of underwriting the failure of the red value states. What people don't recognize is the blue value states put in a dollar of taxes and take out less than a dollar in benefits. The red value states put in a dollar of taxes and take out more than a dollar of benefits. So the blue value states are, in essence, underwriting the failure of the red value states. That's part of it. The other is these, particularly on the West Coast, from Washington, Oregon, California, is that these states which are have blue value orientation. These are socially progressive oriented states. They recognize that not only climate change is real, but that it's going to have huge impacts. They recognize that we have to get out of carbon energy. They recognize that this enormous wealth inequity that the United States has, the greatest in the world, must be reversed. That you can't, a society cannot function as a democracy when two or three people have as much wealth as somewhere between half and two-thirds of the rest of the people. So, you know, when we think about states' rights, we normally think of it as a right-wing push, the southern right-wing states, you know, the Confederacy all over again, all that. But I think what we're going to see and what we are beginning to see is that the blue value states are pushing back and are seeking greater power to move to the state level so that they can deal with these problems. And my prediction is, and I'm making it on the, what is it, the 31st of July, is that within 30 years, you're going to see a very strong shift of power away from the federal government and to the states, because the red states are essentially failing societies. I mean, you look at Mississippi or Alabama, Louisiana. I mean, you're looking at, if they weren't in the United States, they would be developing countries.
Yes.
I mean, the United Nations rapporteur came by and issued a report, which most people didn't pay any attention to, in which he cites the poverty of the United States and says there are large parts of the United States which are essentially third world countries. So we're going to see a shift as those people who are socially progressively oriented demand that their views be listened to and that policies be developed that will support well-being.
Yes, and exactly. And as we come right to the end here, that's beautifully stated, Stefan. I just want to quote you again in terms of your statement that it takes only a small group able to hold a clear intention. And I see that coming forward, and people can continue listening to these living dialogues. And you will hear me talking now as we go forward with millennials and centennials. And the millennials just recently held a march in Washington, D.C. and in 20 cities internationally under the media radar called Zero Hour, about the urgency for action on climate change. And the centennials that started with Parkland's March for Our Lives have a very clear intention when it comes to gun control. All of these things are going to be very, very seriously undermined by Brett Kavanaugh if he gets on the Supreme Court. And so the challenge...
And the lower judges, by the way.
Yes.
You didn't mention the lower judges.
Well,
Trump is stacking the lower courts with people we're going to have to live with for a generation.
Yes, but I'm calling their attention to Kavanaugh, which is something they can do something about right now by calling your senators and putting the pressure on. But with that, we have to leave it right here, Stefan. This is a vision that's doable for the future. I see the millennials and the centennials with their a consciousness of diversity and their vision for the future working with us as elders and everybody in between to make this happen. So the call is out now to our deep listening audience, and with great gratitude to Stefan Schwartz. Stefan, I want to honor you for your whole life work and say what a deep pleasure and excitement it is to almost have these passionate conversations and real dialogues together.
My pleasure, Duncan. I think what you're doing is very important.
And what everybody out there can do and we can do together, holding that clear intention, stay with us and let's do more of this here on Living Dialogues every week, 12:30 to 1 p.m. Mountain Time. Thanks again for your deep listening in evoking this program. All the very best.
listen to KCNU Community Radio every Sunday, 5:30 to 6 p.m. for Colorado Chinese Radio Network with me, your host Christina Guo, reporting news for and about the Chinese community. 欢迎各位听众朋友在每个星期天的下午5:30到6:00在 KCNU 公共电台收听柯州华语广播网玉台有约节目。
KGNU Boulder, Denver, with translators K229AC, Nederland, K254CH, Laporte, and K256CT, Denver, Colorado.
This program is supported by you, the KGNU listener members, and by Boulder Food Rescue, a local nonprofit organization whose goal is to create a more just and less wasteful food system. They facilitate the sustainable redistribution of healthy food to agencies who serve homeless and low-income individuals. Their 6th annual fundraiser takes place on Friday, September 14th from 6 to 10 p.m. at the Jewish Community Center. Tickets and more information can be found at boulderfoodrescue.org.
Have you reserved your seat to KGNU's 40th anniversary celebration, Making Waves? Well, you still have time to get your tickets for an amazing evening with keynote speakers Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! And Jim Hightower of the Hightower Lowdown on Saturday, September 15th in Boulder. Early bird tickets are on sale until this Sunday, August 26th. Tickets and more information available at kgnu.org.
This is the BBC News. Hello, I'm Jonathan Izard. Afghan and NATO forces say the leader of the Islamic State group in Afghanistan has been killed in an airstrike in the eastern province of Nangarhar. Abu Sa'id Erhabi is the fourth IS leader in Afghanistan to be killed in recent years. Anbarasan Adirajan has more details.
This airstrike was carried out overnight in Nangarhar province and they killed Abu Sa'id Erhabi, is considered to be the leader of the IS group in Afghanistan, and 10 other militants. A large amount of ammunition and weapons were also destroyed in this attack. It is significant because IS is gaining ground in Afghanistan. They are very strong in Nangarhar province. They were started only in 2014, but they managed to get a lot of breakaway factions of Taliban and other militant groups in their ranks.
Some news just in. The authorities in the U.S. state of Florida say there's been a mass shooting at a video game tournament in Jacksonville. The local sheriff's office has reported multiple fatalities and ordered people to stay away from the area. The incident happened at a downtown entertainment complex. Pope Francis has vowed to pursue justice for the victims of abuses committed by the Roman Catholic Church and has said it must be firm in establishing the truth. Speaking at a shrine on his second day in Ireland, the Pope said no one could fail to be moved by the stories of those who had been robbed of their innocence. Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, a British-Iranian woman jailed in Iran, has returned to prison in Tehran after an extension of her 3-day release to visit family wasn't granted. Here's James Robbins.
Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe's husband, Richard, says she decided to return to prison in Tehran shortly before the expiry of her 3-day release to avoid being dragged out of the house in front of her 4-year-old daughter, Gabriella. She told him she would walk back into prison with her head held high. He quoted her telling him from Tehran, "You can't send a small child her mummy and then take her away again after 3 days. It is beyond cruel." The charity worker was arrested in April 2016 and accused of encouraging the overthrow of the Iranian regime, something she has always denied.
The American playwright and screenwriter Neil Simon has died at the age of 91. Many of his scripts, drawn from his own experiences, were adapted for film and television. Here's Vincent Dowd.
From the 60s at least to the beginning of this century, when things tailed off a bit, Simon was the dominant Broadway playwright in terms of comedy. He started out on TV, though, with the likes of Larry Gelbart and Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks, a little later Woody Allen, but he was the one who had big stage ambitions always. He was a hit almost from the beginning with Come Blow Your Horn in 1961 and there Barefoot in the Park, which made a star of Robert Redford. Biggest hit of all was probably The Odd Couple. He also wrote the book to a huge musical hit, Sweet Charity. He did so many things, but he said he came from an unhappy family with endless rows between his parents, and that, he said, is what made him into a writer.
World News from the BBC. The Israeli Defence Minister says Israel will reopen the Erez foot crossing with Gaza on Monday, a week after it was closed. Avigdor Lieberman said the decision had been made after several days of calm along the border. It was closed in response to several months of clashes, which are part of a major campaign of protest by Palestinians in Gaza. The president of Namibia says a conference to discuss land expropriation will be held in October. Hage Gottfried Geingob said the government was opening up what he described as difficult policy conversations. Land ownership is currently skewed in favour of the tiny white minority. People in Colombia are voting in a referendum on anti-corruption measures, including a cut in wages for members of Congress. A former member of government said corrupt officials were stealing everything. Nicholas Rocha reports.
Despite efforts to tackle corruption through legislation, more thorough investigations, and even by raising public awareness, the outgoing Contralor General, Edgardo Maya, said recently that corruption was costing the country more than